Okay, folks, you're listening to the latest, and I hope the greatest, I hope each one is greater than the last chapter in the travels, travails, and adventures on life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. And Miss Jones, you've been a lady of mystery to me for the last 2 or 3 days. You've been away. I think you've been north of the border. I'd like to know a little bit about your adventures in travelling away from Planet Porky.
Well, yes, I have. I've been on a plane. I've been on a boat. I've been on a train.
On a jet plane, I don't know when I'll be back again.
Good song, that. Who was that? Peter, Paul, Peter and Paul Mary, Mary, I think, wasn't
Peter,
it?
Peter, Paul and Mary,
yeah. A bit before my time, but a good song nonetheless. Yeah, I've been north of the border. I've flown to Glasgow, been picked up by an assistant, and driven around Loch Lomond and all the way down the Kintyre Peninsula.
Kintyre.
Very, very beautiful part of the world.
Hang on, Kintyre. That triggers something in my head. Mull of Kintyre, or mist rolling in from the sea. It wouldn't have anything to do with that, would it, Miss Jones?
Well, it might. It may well have something to do with that. I tell you what, though, what a fabulous part of the world. I can absolutely understand. Yeah. Paul McCartney obviously had a farm there, a retreat.
He had a huge
and
place.
The Beatles...
It was bigger than a farm. I heard at one time he was about the fourth biggest landowner in Scotland. He bought all the farms around him for privacy.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. So he had a place called High Park Farm and also another one called Low Park Farm.
Right.
And sort of snapped up property everywhere, you're quite right. But as a retreat, so what a perfect place to go when the biggest band in the world collapses, implodes, and you pretty much have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah.
Where are you going to go but somewhere terribly remote where people can't get to you, where you can assimilate in the local society and live a simple life and just get away from the fray?
No, I totally agree. We did actually talk about the Mull of Kintyre video a couple of podcasts ago, you know, about, you know, Denny Lane having a electric guitar that wasn't plugged in, that kind of stuff. So we'll move away from that. But getting back to the breakup of the Beatles, I think Paul nearly became an alcoholic drinking scotch all day, and his wife Linda rescued him from that.
I don't think there's a lot, or maybe there wasn't at that time, maybe there is now more, because there's quite a lot of activities up there. There's, you know, there's fantastic golf and fishing and water sports and people riding their horses on the beaches and all that kind of thing. But there are a lot of pipe bands, and I'm told that nobody drinks like the Pipers.
I'm sure they can.
And of course, Paul McCartney was working with Pipers and so on. But I think that the days are short, especially in winter, being so far. Well, they'd be longer than down here, I suppose, in the winter, wouldn't they? Because they're so much further north. But still short in the winter. And I think drinking whiskey is just part of the culture there.
Well, there's whiskey in the jar. Da, 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 da. I'm very musical today, aren't I, Miss Jones?
Yeah, I was going to say, so melodic
absolutely.
Today.
Absolutely. Anyway, listen, let's move away from that, because as you and I are recording now, this is the week that would have been the 80th birthday of Jimi Hendrix. And I was only a kid when he was around. He died at 27. Remember?
He died on my birthday.
He died on your birthday. We'll come to that in a second. But what I was going to say was that what a fantastically charismatic man, made a huge impression on the world in the few years that he was a rock star. He came from the Caribbean. He settled in London. He died somewhat mysteriously. But he died on your birthday. Tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I never knew him. I was only a child, but it was one of those things that became significant as the older I grew and the more immersed I became in rock and pop music. Yeah. And it felt to me like a bit of a badge to be able to say that the one of the greatest rock guitarists the world had ever seen
yes.
had actually expired on my birthday. Mm. But of course, he had rather a tragic death. First of all, we know he was only 27 years old. Mm. And with a whole career ahead of him, he'd created this incredible genre of music. Mm. They called it sort of improv blues, I suppose. It's a style that's never been bettered.
No.
And improv blues rock would never be outshone. He went for the sort of power trio. He had the thrashing drummer, Mitch Mitchell,
yeah.
and a most melodic bassist, Noel Redding. And together they were the Jimi Hendrix Experience.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, people like Eric Clapton and Pete Townsend deferred to him. Mm. But I think what people didn't realize at the time that most of what he was doing, he stole, first of all, from the Mississippi Bluesmen and from people like Pete Townsend.
Oh, good for him.
But you've heard of a guy called Keith Ortham, I presume.
No, I haven't. No, who's he?
Keith Ortham was one of the great, well, he's still alive, actually. He's a friend, and he is part of the great Scribbs lunch that we did twice a year.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
In fact, he was one of the founders of it. Keith, he was a journalist, music journalist to begin with. He went on to become publicist for The Who, The Stones, mm. Van Morrison, Mark Bolan, people like that. Mm. And Keith was the one who conceived the infamous stunt of Jimi Hendrix setting light to his guitar live on stage.
Well, I thought his most infamous stunt was playing the guitar with his teeth. I mean,
well, that's nothing compared to playing a guitar that's blazing away, is it? Really?
Yeah, well, I suppose not. But you can't actually play a guitar with your teeth, can you? I mean, that must have been just a stunt. I mean, you know, even somebody like Brian May, who has told me and you, he used to play his guitar with old sixpences, using it as a plectrum. How can you use your teeth as a plectrum?
Well, I mean, look, it's all a stunt, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he used to play his guitar behind his back as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The ironic thing with Jimi Hendrix is that he didn't need the stunts because as a performer, as an artist, he was so impressive anyway.
Was he in Woodstock? I can't remember.
Yes, he yeah. was. But, of course, that also was before our time.
Yeah, it so was, yeah.
We only know the hearsay of that
That's right.
Episode, don't
he
we?
He said he died tragically. Can you remind it? He died in a flat in London. Didn't he have an overdose of sleeping tablets or something?
Yeah, it was an apartment hotel. He had a kind of on-off girlfriend, a German. She was a former figure skater called Monica Dannemann. Uh-huh. And she had some medication, which was kind of sleeping tablets. The label on the box was in German.
Mm.
And Jimmy presumably couldn't read the dosage.
Yeah.
He misinterpreted the dosage.
Right.
Mayo, if he read it at all. But he took something like five times the recommended dose.
That's so tragic.
And he'd also been drinking red wine, so he vomited and asphyxiated on his own vomit. Monica came home to the flat,
yeah.
didn't call the ambulance quickly enough yeah. when she found him. And so this conspiracy theory arose because she, I suppose she was scared. Yeah. She was just a young girl and she was in a foreign country. She didn't realize what she was up against. Yeah. And she kept changing her story every time she told it. And all down the years, the story changed slightly, yeah. you know. So a conspiracy theory is going to flourish in such circumstances, isn't it, really?
I'm sure it is. And for those millions of listeners here to Planet Porky who might think, what are you going on about Jimi Hendrix for? He died at 27, but he would now have been of the stature of Keith Richards and Mick Jagger had he been allowed to live, because he was such a charismatic guy. He was. I saw him. I remember this all my life. I saw him on the Michael Parkinson show. Okay, Michael. I think it was Michael Parkinson, but it might have been the other guy who used to do lots of interviews in those days, a former barrister who was quite, you know, smarmy and liked himself a bit. I can't remember his name now. But the question was, so Jimmy. You know, I mean, what is the life of a rock star? I mean, for instance, you know, do you act normally like other people? Do you go to bed and get up every day? And his response was, he said, oh, yeah, man, I do try to get up every day. which, of course, we understand because rock stars used to work all night and then get up later, didn't they? But anyway, look.
A lot of artists record through the night. It's kind of their territory, isn't it? It's those the twilight hours are very comfortable for them to record.
Is that right? But, because the Stones went to the south of France and recorded, I think, Satanic Majesties or whatever it was.
No, that was Exile on Main Street.
Exile on Main Street, thank you. Apparently, they didn't start till 10 o'clock at night, and then, full of, substances and booze and all that, and then all packed up at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, went around the swimming pool, and changed, like, day to night and night to day. I couldn't do that, frankly.
Yeah, it's very common in that world. Yeah. But Keith Ortham, who I mentioned just now, he also has the distinction of having been the last writer ever to interview Jimi Hendrix, and that was at the Cumberland Hotel in Marble Arch.
Yeah, well, that is right at the end of Oxford Street.
Yeah, just 5 days before Jimmy's death. But that hotel is, it was a sleaze pit in those days, but it's a branch of the Hard Rock Hotel, Hard Rock Cafe chain now. Wow. And you go in ground floor, they've got a lovely stage in there and a nice venue. And a few friends of mine have played gigs there as well.
I got thrown out of that hotel bar.
I bet you did.
No, I tell you, it's a really strange story. A mate of mine, an American mate of mine, who I worked with in America, came over called Dick. And I'm trying to remember his second name now. I was going to say...
It doesn't really matter what the second name is, does it?
No, I was going to say Murray, but it wasn't. I'll remember his name in a minute. And he was both a newspaper columnist for the New York Times. New York Daily News, which was based in the same building as me in New York, the Superman building on 42nd Street, right. But he was also an early pioneer of radio, when journalists became radio jocks and that kind of stuff. And he's very good. Dick Oliver. Sorry, that's his name. Dick Oliver. Yeah. And he came over to this country for a visit with his wife. And we got invited to a party by Noel Botham. I don't know if you've ever heard of Noel Botham, but he was the European editor of the National Enquirer, right?
I'm sure I've met him. That name is very familiar
exactly.
to me.
And Noel had a big place down in Surrey. So it was a Sunday lunch, and I tell you who was there, amazing, was Huey Green. And that's where I first found out about Huey Green and his connection to...
Paula Yates.
Paula Yates, yeah, he told the story over lunch. It was an amazing sort of day. But anyway, we had a great lunch, and Dick and his wife were staying at the Cumberland Hotel. And so we got a car to take us back into London, and it was in the very early days of mobile phones, but we managed to get a call through on, somebody's mobile phone to New York and, a lot of laughter, shout and all that. So he went into the bar, the Cumberland Hotel, and neither of us had paid for anything all day because Noel was so generous. And so, right, okay, Dick, go and sit down. I'm getting these. And Dick, who used to smoke big cigars like a typical American, said, no, Parry, no, this is mine. You've been so good and generous because I provided all the transport to the, the party. I said, no, you're not. Anyway, when I got my money out, Dick leapt on me and wrestled me to the ground, right?
Oh.
And I said, Dick, he said, you're not paying. Anyway, the manager came over and said, we don't tolerate drunkenness in this bar. and of course, we looked up and said, no, we're not drunk. We're just fighting over paying the bar tab, No, you're out. And Dick said, but I'm a resident here. He said, you may be a resident here. You can go to your room, but you're not in my bar. Honestly, an amazingly silly story. But
so what did you do? Go up to his room and order room service?
No, we went to like a bar down Oxford Street or something. It was shocking. But anyway, there you go. I tell you who was with me on that day. My escort was Ms. Carol Malone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean...
I know about you two.
No, come on. No, that's being mischievous. I knew...
No, it isn't, because you have actually told me in a drunken stupor that there was something between you two.
Well, Carol and I were boyfriend and girlfriend up in the northeast of England when I was working on the Newcastle Evening Chronicle and she was working on the North Shields Weekly News, can you believe? And we both ended up in Fleet Street, and when we got this invitation to go and see Noel Botham, we both, I said, come with me, and so we did. But anyway, Carol's a lovely girl. In fact, I saw her just last week when we past each other on two Jeremy Vine shows and all that. Anyway, that's for another day. Tell me.
There's way more to this. Well, I think we're going to have to pursue this one in a future episode.
Listen, talking about Oxford Street, by the way, did you ever remember in the sort of the 70s or the 80s walking up and down Oxford Street and seeing the Hare Krishna mob? In the
orange, they were kind of monks, weren't they?
Absolutely. And beating their drums and singing Hare Krishna. And lo and behold.
Oh, jingling the bells as well.
Jingling the bells, absolutely right. Yeah. Lo and behold, George Harrison got into it because it's Hinduism. And you know, of course, that our present Prime Minister, Mr. Rishi Sunak, is a Hindu, right? And so this is all starting to make sense to me. I felt a real persuasion towards the lifestyle of the Hare Krishna mob. And I did at one time think, you know, during some job where it was all high pressure and you get stressed out and all that, would it be worth giving away all my worldly goods and joining the Hare Krishna movement? Because George Harrison made it sound, I mean, it's 10 years on from when George Harrison brought out All Things Must Pass, you know what I mean? So I was like, you know, 27, 28 or something like that. And I thought, I'm going to listen to all George Harrison's records again and see whether this is a calling.
Well, how interesting, because I've always had a feeling that religions are cultural.
Yeah.
And all religions seem to point towards a force for the good and a belief in a divine creator.
Yeah.
But depending on where you come from in the world, I mean, there are obviously differences, such as, you know, obviously we know in Christianity that we have God and we have the Trinity of God Almighty and Jesus and the Holy Ghost.
Yeah.
And other religions seem to have interpretations of that. Mm. Some religions seem to have many sort of sub-gods, but there's always a divine creator, as there is in Hinduism.
Mm.
But I had a look at it because, in fact, when my daughter was studying theology at school many years ago, I remember reading one of her books. And I remember this from reading way back then.
Mm.
Hindus believe in the continuous cycle of life.
Yeah.
So that, you know, death, reincarnation, it's all part of the same thing. We don't have reincarnation in Christianity.
No.
But they also have something that has affected us all, even if subliminally, because karma is a way of life by which many people live these days.
Mm.
Which is the universal law of cause and effect, isn't it? So
I don't know. Tell me.
It's what we would otherwise call do as you would be done by.
Right. Okay.
If you do something bad to somebody, chances are it's going to come back at you, and that is karma.
You're right.
Okay. And you hear people say things like karma is a bitch, or you know, karma's going to get you, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But it is a sort of physical law of cause and effect, which I suppose we all do follow that to some extent.
I agree. I wish I had the courage to actually do what I've just said to you. I wouldn't give away all my worldly goods, by the way, because if that was a rule that you could only enter the Hare Krishna movement by giving everything away, that would debar me, because I'd say to myself, no, I don't want to give it to you lot. In case you spend it badly, I'll give it to my family. So I will give it away, but I'll give it to my family, but I'll come and join you and all that kind of stuff, you know. But
could you live with nothing? I don't see that.
I don't think I could, to be honest. I've always been a capitalist. I've always been very materialistic. I've always liked to be comfortable. But it would be a massive change in lifestyle, which might be so severe, you know what I mean? Which I might suddenly think, hang on, I've got nothing to worry about today. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I think I'm rambling now, so I think I'll move on. Did you ever get big into Disney films when you were young, Miss Jones? Did you ever take your children to Disney World? Is Disney ever been a big thing in your life?
Not really. When my eldest was about 6, I was in Los Angeles. I used to take her. She must have been a bit younger than that, because before she went to school.
Yeah.
I was living in Los Angeles at one point, and I used to take her on all the jobs that I was doing at that time. We were in Los Angeles. I took her to Disneyland, which is it's in Los Angeles, and it's the original.
The original, but the other one in Florida is Disney World, is it?
That's Disney World, and that's the big sort of much more modern, much more sprawling kind of facility. But there was something rather quaint about the original Disneyland.
Yes.
and she went on a few rides and we saw a few characters and stuff. Never really got that much into films, but so never went to the cinema to see any of them. But I can remember buying the videos of the classic films such as Dumbo and Bambi and Lady and the Tramp.
Absolutely. My mum took me to see, what's the one with the elephant? Is that Dumbo? Yeah.
That's Dumbo,
I remember as a kid I was absolutely heartbroken because I think the little elephant's ears fell off or something, you know.
Oh, don't. I mean, there was a lot of kind of pathos in those films. Yeah. You know, in Bambi, and Bambi's mum gets shot and all the rest of it.
Terrible.
You know, there's a lot of tragedy there. Yeah. But the sort of more modern Disney adaptations, which my other two kids gone into further down the line. Mm. So all the stories like Aladdin, The Lion King, you know, The Jungle Book, all those sort of treatments of classic stories made into Disney films.
Yeah.
I mean, they're brilliantly done, but there's something I don't know, slightly, I know it's very American, so it's not English as such, but there's something, just maybe something a little bit vulgar about them.
Well, I don't watch them, to be honest, because I always think you know, I prefer films like, sort of, I suppose you'd call them more like boy films, you know, like The Bourne Identity and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? But
yeah, but if you've got a kid watching The Lion King, they're not going to watch The Bourne
Identity. No, I totally agree.
Know what I mean.
Of course I know what you mean, yeah. But no, the reason I brought it up is that they're a massive corporation now. I mean, they're so big that Rupert Murdoch, who was already one of the, you know, biggest media moguls in the world, felt he had to sell out part of his empire to Disney, otherwise he was going to be swallowed up by them. You know what I mean? That's how massive they are. But in the last quarter, I think they've racked up losses of something like about, and happy to be corrected if I'm wrong, about $1.3 billion or something like that. You know, billion, not million. And as a result, the boss has left, and the guy who used to run them and made them so successful, a guy called Bob Iger, has come back to take over again. Now, the reason I'm telling you all this, when I said I haven't seen Disney films, but I've been on the very first Disney cruise liner, okay? You won't believe this, but as part of what we call a facility trip in our business, Miss Jones, you know.
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
A freebie, yes, thank you. And we...
Backhander, in other words.
Not a backhander, Miss Jones. I am completely independent in the way I wrote my review about being on the Disney Cruise Liner.
Of course you are, yes.
Obviously.
No,
you know, with free champagne and a first-class suite and all that, you know what I mean?
Quite right, too. Over at the Daily Mail, meanwhile, we were not allowed to accept freebies from anybody, and we had to remain completely impartial. So we could never accept a flight, a ticket, a dinner, a lunch, any of that. We had to, and in fact, 9 times out of 10 when we went on a job, we had to try and not let the people who were throwing whatever it was know that we were there.
Right. Okay. Well, thank goodness I was in charge of things at the Daily Express, because the offers came in all the time, of course, and I used to pick off the best ones for myself, you know, including going across the Atlantic on the QE2 liner, which, of course, is no more, but it was the best liner in the world in those days. But I saw this one and I thought, oh, this would be good. So it was the first trip of the first Disney cruise liner, and it went from, get this, we had to fly out to Miami and get on the boat that went to the Bahamas. You know,
oh, how utterly terrible for you.
Absolutely, utterly shocking, you know. But it was an amazing ship, because, you know, it was shaped like Mickey Mouse. You know, the funnel wasn't a funnel, it was like a Mickey Mouse funnel going, but it was utterly fantastic. First time ever, we were in the dining room and they said, oh, we've got this fantastic new concept. And the dining room changed colour every 15 minutes. So it was white, then it was blue, then it was red, then it was black. It was amazing, you know.
Oh, that would make you throw up after a few drinks, wouldn't it?
But anyway, I've got a very poignant reason to mention this. One of the other people on the trip was Sue Carroll. And you probably knew Sue as well as I did you?
I did know Sue, yes. Yep. She was columnist on the Daily Mirror.
Absolutely. Sue Carroll.
And a TV presenter as well.
TV presenter and a Geordie girl. And she became deputy editor of the News of the World, right? She did very well. And I remember when she got the job, she was so thrilled, not just that she'd been made deputy editor of the News of the World, to a lady called Patsy. Was it Patsy McCall?
Patsy Chapman.
Patsy Chapman, thank you. Yeah, that's right, Patsy Chapman. So there was two ladies at the top of the News of the World. But she was...
So this was pre-Piers Morgan, which is where I came in at the News of the World.
Exactly. But she was most thrilled by the fact that what came with the job was an open-top Mercedes sports car. And Sue was a very glamorous girl, as I'm sure you'll admit. You know, she had long, flowing blonde hair and she was, you know, outgoing and lovely-looking girl and all that. And the reason this is so poignant is she was on the trip and we had a great time together and a few drinks, all that. Nothing ever romantic between us because she had a regular boyfriend, you know, which we won't go into.
Oh, it wasn't just a regular boyfriend. It was a passionate love affair, wasn't it?
Yeah, but unfortunately it was with a man who was married, wasn't it? And that was, you know, that was in itself an amazing story. But anyway, point of this is that about, I suppose, when was that? Maybe 5 years afterwards, all of a sudden, Sue went down with pancreatic cancer. It's the most terrible disease and not many people ever recover from it, you know. And I heard about this, it was terrible. And I went to, I think it was the Brompton Hospital down the Brompton Road to see her. And it was one of those heartbreaking things, Leslie, and which you must have been through yourself when, you know, this is probably the last time I'm going to see this person. You know, it was horrible.
Yeah, I remember going into that very hospital to see Hugh McIlvenny, the sports writer, who was my father's closest friend.
Sure. Yeah.
And he was full of it. You know, he was a ferocious man, quite a combative Scot, and refusing to lie down and give in to it, and was fighting fit and talking about what he was going to do when he got out of the place.
Yes.
And I remember walking back out afterwards thinking, I'm never going to see you again.
Exactly.
And then I was on a train about a month later and he called me.
Wow.
I can't remember what it was about. And we had this lovely chat and he was a completely different person on this call. And he was sending benevolent wishes to all and sundry and asking me to make a note to make sure I said this to this one and that to that one.
Yeah.
And I came off that call thinking again. Yeah. That's the last time we're ever going to speak.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's a bit of a maudlin subject to get into, but it's very poignant, you know, and I left Sue. She'd had a stroke as well. The drugs that she was given were so intense to try and stop the pancreatic cancer. It gave her a stroke and her face was dislodged, you know what I mean? It was a very difficult visit and trying to tell how, you know, lovely she looked and all that. Anyway, let's get away from that. Okay, folks, you must fancy a free case of delicious beers, as the festive season is all around us. And it's a World Cup festive season. That makes it better, does it not? And right now, your very good friends and mine, Beer 52, have this great offer. They've got this great deal. Yes, a free case of 8 craft beers. I mean it. Simply go to www.beer52.com/Porky, okay? And all you have to do is to cover the very humble postage cost of £5.95 to claim your free case. Now, I've been a member of Beer 52, folks, for many moons, and I love it. Unashamedly, I'm telling you, I love it, okay? Each month, they send their members a new case of beer from a different part of the world. What a Christmas you can have, tasting those planet-wide beers and a World Cup with world-flavoured beers, okay? Beers from 40 countries, over 5 continents, juicy pales to strong-tasting stouts. We're the world's number one beer club, Beer 52, number one beer club in the world. Dark or light, it's all there. You also get our Ferment magazine. That's what it's called. It's called Ferment. And you get some tasty snacks in that box of beers that'll come to you. And if you're not satisfied, and this is, you know, a really lovely gesture, if you're not satisfied, you can cancel at any time. So that's www.beer52.com/Porky, P-O-R-K-Y, to claim your free case right now. I'll give you that just one more time. It's www.beer52.com beer52.com/porky to claim your free case right now. Just pay the postage. That's it. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones, the rock chick writer extraordinaire. Ms. Jones, have you ever heard of a guy called Keith Levine?
Yeah, he was a member of The Clash.
That's what I'm saying. I never got
into one of the best bands in punk.
I never got into The Clash. I don't know why people thought they were. Was they London Calling and all that? London Calling. Da, 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 da. London. I preferred the group that did Cool for Cats. Who was that?
Oh, the Stray Cats, wasn't it?
No, no, Cool for Cats.
Cool for Cats. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The Sweeney's doing 90 because they got nowhere to go. They grab a pair of villains in a shed up at Heathrow. That one, yeah.
Yeah, I actually can't remember who did
Neither can I.
How unlike me.
Yeah, but anyway. There you go.
It might come to me in a minute.
Anyway, poor old Clash guitarist Keith Levine.
Oh, I'll tell you who it was. I know who it was. It was Squeeze.
Just remember, yeah. Squeeze. Absolutely right, yeah. But
it came to us both at the same time.
Yeah.
No, you must remember Joe Strummer. I mean, what a cool guy he was. Mm-hmm. They were quite preachy as an outfit, right. But, I mean, blinding music and lyrics.
Yes.
And Joe Strummer, in fact, he had a very strange heart condition,
right,
which would be of interest to you. He had this thing where, I think it's called an intramural coronary artery, mm-hmm. where one of your main blood vessels yeah. grows inside the actual heart muscle.
Oh, golly, that sounds
weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really grim. So he was never going to last long. He was only 50 when he died.
Right,
but God. Keith Levine lasted a bit longer. He was 65.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it comes to us all, doesn't it, whether you're a rock star or not, and it's very sad.
Oh, yes.
Talking about music, mm-hmm. by the way, I don't think I've ever revealed to you, Miss Jones, that as I get older, I have become more and more fond of classical music rather than, you know, the Beatles and all the rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. And if I'm sometimes sitting at one of my penthouses one night and telly's got nothing on, a bit boring, I put on a record by a bloke who's a Russian composer, and his name is Prokofiev, okay? And he's made lots of really good stuff, but one of them is called The Dance of the Nights, and I absolutely adore it. Have you ever heard it?
I'm sure I must have. It sounds like quite a famous piece.
Well, I'll hum a bit of it to you, okay?
Go on then, go on.
This.
Oh, I know the one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very, very dramatic.
Oh, it's so powerful, honestly.
Yeah, no. It is quite sinister, though, that piece. It's interesting. How do you listen to your classical music? What medium do you listen to it on?
I put it through my television, like everything else. You know what I mean? I just go on to the, Spotify, and just pick it out, and it goes, you know?
Oh, okay. So you're listening to Spotify. Yeah,
yeah.
I just wondered if you were listening to classic FM radio or something.
Well,
like that.
I do like a bit of that when I'm in the car and all that kind of stuff, but of course, you can't select what you want to hear when you're just listening to a radio station, whereas you can pick it out if you want to get it off Spotify or something like that, you know what I mean?
Sure, sure. I've always liked classical music, actually.
Yeah.
I suppose it stems back to school when we were first introduced to it, because my mum and dad didn't listen to classical.
Yeah.
My father was much more into artists like Frank Sinatra,
right,
and Sammy Davis Jr.
Right,
and
yeah.
Tony
yeah.
Bennett and all those.
Right.
So I've got his whole record collection, so mm-hmm. I still got all those.
Yeah.
But there wasn't much classical in the mix. Mantovani was about as classical as it got at home.
I like all the Beethoven stuff, you know. Do you know what I can't work out?
I don't think that was Beethoven.
No, I think it was. Or it's Mozart. Could have been Mozart. or
it doesn't sound like either of them.
Could have been Chopin. Maybe Chopin. No, Chopin played the piano, actually, didn't he?
Do you remember that wine bar in Covent Garden all those years ago called Brahms and Liszt?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Because I had no idea, because I was so genteelly brought up,
yeah,
that I had no idea that it was Cockney rhyming slang for being drunk.
Being pissed, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Family show.
Family show.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, I
don't know. It was a good wine bar, though. I can remember spending hours in that place. Yeah. You know, you'd go in after work and you'd still be there at 11 o'clock at night. No, absolutely three sheets to the wind. Yeah.
No, I do like that. It sort of calms me down a bit, the old classical stuff, you know. But then if you had to make a choice, obviously, I wouldn't swap Strawberry Fields Forever, even for Prokofiev's Dance of the Nights. But there we are. Now, Miss Jones, I've come across this survey, and I think it's very relevant to yourself and myself at our time of life. And it says this: having a sense of direction and goals in life lowers the risk of an early death. Scientists at Harvard, which obviously is a very famous university, at the Harvard Public Health School, say that having purpose in life protects you against death from all sorts of other causes. Now, that's all very well, but you and I have been going for a long time, Miss Jones. We have to get up every day and we have to be optimistic and look forward and have something to, you know, go for that day. Do you find that a big pressure in your life? And do you agree with this survey that having goals is a big tick for a longer and healthier life?
I absolutely agree with that. The times when I get twitchy and miserable are when I'm between gigs, let's say, between jobs. So if I've just handed in a book, it's a bit like having a baby. You get the sort of postnatal depression because you've finished one project and you've it's like giving birth. You give birth and suddenly your baby isn't within you anymore. Mm. You've shared it with the world. You've given it out there and everybody's now having a go at it. Yeah. And it's the same thing with putting in a manuscript for a new book. Sure. And then you've got that lull in between when you don't know what book you're going to write next, when you know maybe you'll never get another publishing contract.
Yes.
I mean, everything is so precarious nowadays.
Yes.
There are no guarantees. Mm. But when I'm working, when I'm on a project, I know exactly what I'm doing, and I've got my deadlines all in my diary, and it's all in place.
Yes.
I get up every day, and I know what's required of me. Mm. I've made my own schedule, and I know what I've got to do.
Yeah.
I am so happy because I'm being useful and I'm doing the thing that I love doing the most, which is writing.
Yes, that's great. I totally agree with you. Professionally, I always want to go for it. I keep coming up with great ideas for great TV shows, you know what I mean? And I bang them off to a load of producers and program directors and heads of station and all that. And inevitably, they either get ignored or some of the, you know, nicer, better guys I work with come and ladies as well come back and say, "Hi, Mike, thanks very much. Lovely idea and all that. You know, how would it work with this?" And then you send back that, "How would it work?" "Yeah, I'm not sure." You know what I mean? But it keeps me going because one of these days I'm certain I'm going to discover, you know, something like Britain's Got Talent, you see what I mean, or something like that, because you just...
Or the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which was devised by Chris Briggs, who I used to work with.
Really? Tell me about that.
Oh, yeah. Years ago, long, long time ago. Music business, Capital Radio, all that.
Yes.
But, you know, just an ordinary person, one of us, who comes up with a brilliant idea, just like a news flash in your head, and there it is, there you have it. And it's the thing that you go forward with, and it makes you a fortune.
I totally agree. It's turning the idea into reality, which is so difficult, isn't it? You know, because you've got to find the funding. I mean, look, Simon Cowell must be the most brilliant man in the world. I don't know what he did before he became a TV mogul.
Well, he worked in the music business.
Yeah.
And he was also bankrupt
one point.
Oh, he lost, lost everything.
So how did he suddenly come up with all these brilliant ideas like The X Factor and Britain's Got Talent and all that?
As we just said, you know, you troll along and you're flinging ideas left, right and centre and some of them work, some of them don't. Yeah. You lose all your money. You start all over again. Yeah. And then suddenly you have the kernel of the idea that is the thing that is going to turn your fortunes around. A concept that can be sold as a format all over the world, adapted to the culture of different countries and that can feature artists in those countries that will never see the light of day anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because it's so adaptable, an idea like The X Factor.
Absolutely.
Or whichever country's got talent, you know. And it's basically reality. It's putting ordinary people with a talent for something on television. It's like Opportunity Knocks. It's the modern version.
It is. Huey Green, Opportunity Knocks. I remember that so well.
Huey Green's having a good podcast this week, isn't he?
He's having a very good one. You're absolutely right, yeah. Okay, folks, let me tell you, quite sincerely, you know, when all this kind of...
I tell you what, though, he wasn't very sincere at all, was he? But, as it turned out. But the other thing was, I never saw him as a sex symbol. So to hear that he was a bit of a shaggy...
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
It's really... Yeah. I mean, he went up in my estimation,
No, I totally agree with that. I really do. The show I'm trying to get off the ground is a show to support motorists. As far as I'm concerned, motorists are now subject to such onerous rules, regulations, fines, impositions, you know, roads closed down for low energy zones, bike lanes, bus lanes. And so I've put it around. Look, surely there's got to be a great show somewhere supporting the motorist. You know, there's 40 million of us in this country. We pay enormous amounts of money and we're smacked down all the time by cyclists and people who want us to drive at 20 miles an hour. And yet, for some reason, I can't get anybody to get going on it.
I couldn't agree more, especially on a day when I got a penalty charge notice, do not ignore, from the Dart Charge people, because it's one of those days when, you know, there was all that disruption from people climbing up the gantries, the stop oil people and all of that.
And the
M25 route that I wanted to take, I couldn't go that way. I had to go another way. Yeah. And I did end up having to go over the bridge because the protesters were down the other end of the M25. Yeah. And I didn't, because I don't do this routinely, I saw the sign on the left and thought, I better pay that when I get home because it's only about a fiver or something. Mm. It's not a big deal. Mm. But then I was away from home for several days because I was doing book festivals and different things. So by the time I got home, a few days later, I forgot to do it.
Right.
But you only get until the day after to pay it anyway. Right. I just forgot, you know. I'm not a criminal. And so now I've got a fine for £35, which I think is very unfair.
Well, do you know what? Last time I came over that bridge, because I've got a place over in Suffolk, right? So I have to go over the bridge and then turn right up the A14, go through Ipswich up to the Aldborough coast, you know. And the last time I was just daydreaming. I was in my car. I was on the phone or something like that. I sailed straight across. And about a week later, I thought, do you know what? I done it. And so I rang them up, believe it or not. And, you know, you and I are a bit the same, really. If you owe somebody £5, you think you've got to pay it and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I rang them up and I said, look, I'm very sorry. I said, I'll save you the bother of sending me something in the post. And they said, I'm sorry, we've got no record of you or your registration plate crossing the bridge, Mr. Parry, but thanks for the call. So I don't know whether everybody gets clocked, you know.
Well, I tell you what that is, because I had this when my son was in a pantomime. Yep. Oh, yes, he was in Basildon last year.
Yep.
And I did go up to Basildon several times to see him performing in it. Yep. And the very first time I went over the bridge and forgot to pay the charge because I just forgot.
Yep.
And I did similar to you. I called them up because I remembered when it was too late. And I said, oh, goodness me, I wanted to pay this, but blah, blah, blah. And they said, no, you have the first one free.
Oh.
So maybe that was your first time over the bridge.
Maybe it was, because I was always much happier. I know it took a bit longer because you had to slow down for about 5 or 6 or 7 minutes and then get to the barrier and chucking those 3 £1 coins into the basket, you know what I mean? But then you know you'd paid. You know what I mean? You know, you'd actually paid. Or, I don't know if they have it anymore, even people in little glass boxes who you would hand a fiver to. At least you knew you'd paid, you know what I mean?
I tell you why they had to abandon those, though, was because it was so unhealthy for the people working at that job.
Yeah.
Because all they were doing was breathing in carbon monoxide all day.
I agree. And, of course, it caused massive tailbacks if there were only 2 gates open, you know, or 2 barriers instead of 5 or something like that. But anyway, there you go. I still think that driving in this country now is becoming real pain in the arse territory, you know. And
I couldn't agree more.
And the traffic Taliban are about to force us all off the roads. Miss Jones, I have to say to you that I was a student at the University of Trent many years ago, of course. And
now let me stop you there.
Yes.
Because I happen to have something in common with you.
Oh, what's that?
When you went to the University of Trent, it was actually Trent Polytechnic, wasn't it?
It may have been called that in those days. As far as I'm concerned now, I am an alma mater of the...
No, it is your alma mater.
It's my alma mater. It's my alma mater, the University of the Trent. Thank you very much, yes.
Okay. Well, we do have that in common because I went...
I don't remember you being at the University of Trent.
No, but in London, there was the very grand Polytechnic of Central London, where I studied, which is now the University of Westminster.
There you go. There you go.
So it's the same thing. So, you know, what is a university or a college or a seat of learning by any other name?
Absolutely. Anyway, the reason I mention this is because it was in Nottingham. Nottingham's a fine city, Robin Hood's home, obviously, and all that. And I lived in a place called Lenton. And to get to the college buildings, we had to walk through Nottingham Castle. Now, I don't mean like, you know, a little castle. Nottingham Castle is a big estate. You see what I mean? The castle's at the end of it, but all the grounds there, a bit like Windsor Castle, I suppose. You see what I mean? But it's in the middle of the town. And we walk through and we go to a few lectures, not many. That's why I decided to leave after the first year. And then on the way home, before we went through the castle gates, we'd go into a pub called Ye Old Trip to Jerusalem.
Oh.
And it is... It claims to be the oldest pub in England. There's a couple of others that claim that, but I think it was 1192. And it's where literally the Crusaders would gather and drink, you know, mulled wine and all that, and then set off for the Holy Land, you know, which used to take them about like 10 months to get there or something like that. But the old trip to Jerusalem, beautiful pub, but it's actually built into the castle walls. It's a cave. It's literally a cave, you know, with a frontage on it. And the reason I brought this up is because it came to my attention that Nottingham Castle, as a tourist destination, has had to be closed down because they had a £30 million refurbishment to make it, quote, a world-class attraction. And now they're in so much debt that they're not allowed to trade. It says here, after the opening of the castle last year, residents complained that they were being priced out of visiting the castle because they were being charged £13 entry fee plus add-ons for other parts of the site. And unfortunately, the number of people coming in dipped, and now they've closed it. And I feel very, very sorry about one of our great, you know, attractions in this country, Nottingham Castle, Robin Hood and all that. It happens to too many of our great monuments, Miss Jones.
Well, unfortunately, it's going to happen to many more. These tourist attractions closing down, they won't make it.
Yeah.
A lot of it is to do with the cost of the gas and electricity, the energy crisis. Swimming pools are closing down all over the country because they can't afford to heat the places.
I know, blimey. Life is changing. We thought that life would always improve and life would get better every year, but...
I think it will. I think we're in a hiatus at the moment.
Yeah, I think you're right,
We could be in a recession that might last a couple of years, but I think we'll always bounce back.
Well, of course we will, because we'll always find, I mean, for instance, Russia haven't got anything like the hold over us now that they used to have with gas, because we all now have to go out around the world and find energy from other places, which will eventually become cheaper because of the amount that, you know, we buy from them and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, look, this is not a podcast to get into politics or anything like that. One last thing, Miss Jones. This is also the week of Winston Churchill's birthday. I mean, during the course of my life, when I was born and brought up, my father served in the Second World War, 6 years in the Royal Navy. Winston Churchill was equivalent to God in our household. And I remember when he died, and my father weeping, you know, I think it was in the mid-60s, might have been
1965.
Thank you very much indeed, and all that kind of stuff, you know. And during the course of my life ever since, how many years is it since? I don't know, about 50. Winston Churchill's reputation and image has been chipped away at by people who don't want to accept what he did for this country.
Things came out, didn't they? There were campaigns in earlier years that I don't know a lot about because I wasn't around, and we didn't study that kind of history when I was at school. You know, history was the Tudors and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
When I did history.
No, you're right. I never studied the Second World War at school.
No, but I think there were various dark phases in his life, which more were made of in years to come, weren't there?
Yeah, there were. I mean, look, as far as I'm concerned, if it wasn't Winston Churchill, we'd all now be speaking German. That's the one thing I always say to people to try and close the argument, you know. Of course, if you did what Winston Churchill had to do, occasionally you have to do bad things, you know. But anyway, look, as I say, this is not a political podcast, but it has been a joy once again, Mr. Jones, to have been chatting with you and talking with you and debating the issues over the last 45 minutes. And I say to everybody else, thank you very much indeed for listening. And we'll be back with you from Planet Porky this time next week. I tell you who was with me on that day. My escort was Ms. Carol Malone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
I know about you two.
No, come on. No, that's being mischievous.
No, it isn't, because you have actually told me in a drunken stupor that there was something between you two.
Well, Carol and I were boyfriend and girlfriend up in the northeast of England, and I was working on the Newcastle Evening Chronicle, and she was working on the North Shields Weekly News, can you believe? And we both ended up in Fleet Street, and when we got this invitation to go and see Noel Botham, we both, I said, come with me, and so we did. But anyway, Carol's a lovely girl. In fact, I saw her just last week when we passed each other on two Jeremy Vine shows and all that. Anyway, that's for another day. Tell me...
There's way more to this. Well, I think we're going to have to pursue this one.
As I get older, I have become more and more fond of classical music rather than, you know, the Beatles and all the rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. And if I'm sometimes sitting at one of my penthouses one night and telly's got nothing on, a bit boring, I put on a record by a bloke who's a Russian composer, and his name is Prokofiev, okay? I felt a real persuasion towards the lifestyle of the Hare Krishna mob